General, having a few more experimental thoughts in this series is something I find like. So if anyone has suggestions for other speakers or could offer to talk about an experimental subject, that would be nice. Anyway, a while ago I asked for everyone to talk about what's with us. At the right kind of level, that theoreticians also can understand it. And he kindly agreed.
Thanks, Jonathan, for bringing us over here. I have to switch this to some less aggressive power conserving mode. So in thinking about what to talk about here, I decided that I wouldn't take you into too much detail of what I currently actually do, but keep it, at least for the first part, slightly more general, and then go into some details later. Now, okay, later. So I decided to devote at least the first half of this talk to a sort of overview of all the components that we would need for optical quantum information processing, and then speak about my current projects, which involve development of sources, particular sources of tangled pairs, in the latter half. And Chris is here. There. Chris is working on quantum key distribution, which I'm not going to talk about today. And Rolf is working on that source development. I'm collaborating for this with a lot of people all over the world, you can see. Now, so I'll start by telling you a bit about where optical quantum information processing stands these days, and then take you into the photon space, as I call it, and give you the various ways in which we can use photons for quantum information processing. And then I'll go step by step through different elements of that, and we can discuss, you know, how good they are and how bad they are, and what the prospects are for optical quantum information processing. I think there's a bit of a difference when, if I'm not mistaken, on the North American roadmap for quantum information processing, there's not a lot about optics. The European has more. Peter Zolling, you probably read the European version of the QIST roadmap, and it has more optics in there than the North American. And then finally, the second or third of my talk, I'll talk about sources and about how to get better sources of entangled pairs using photonic crystals. Now, for the status of optical quantum information processing, I think it's fair to say that it dominates quantum key distribution. We've seen teleportation done in a variety of systems. But I think the most impressive ones are in optics, because that's the only way you can cover an actual distance, right? If you do teleportation in an ion trap, you teleport over 2 microns, which might be important for implementing gates in there, but it won't make quantum computers communicate. Now, we also have seen, the nicest preparations of highly entangled states in optics. Although I'm told that inofficially we have 8 qubits entangled in ion traps now, so a qubit. I don't know how well controlled that is yet, but anyway. And so I'll go into why we are at 5 photons now, and why we've been at 5 photons for a little while, or 4 photons maybe, and why haven't we done 6? Then. Other parts that involve optics are then more in quantum communication repeaters, but also there's linear optics quantum computation, as invented by Manuel Rosenbaum and Jared Milburn, and we've seen some very elementary demonstrations of that in experiments in Vienna. And I'll keep one thing for everything. That we need entangled pairs for. I'll have a little yellow star block here, and And right now, I'm only marking the ones that I won't be talking about anymore. So I want to give you the importance of sources. That's, I mean, everybody has their specialty. Some people specialize in detectors, and I decided to specialize in sources. And I'll hope to convince you that that's an interesting topic. Now, if we look at the photon and into how we want to use it for quantum information processing, we can basically use all its properties, and there's various ways we can do that. The most obvious way, I guess, is polarization, and I call it the Poincaré sphere here, which is equivalent to the Bach sphere, except that your real space angles are different because you have a spin 1 particle and not a spin, not a true spin half particle. But in general, you have to consider your application, and you have to consider the environment that couples to that photon. And you'll have to consider questions of scalability when deciding on how to encode your information. And I think one general guideline is that we will need, it's not sufficient to take one mode and then just put more and more photons into that mode. I think we know that. I'm taking this information from, I guess, papers by Manny Creel. I don't know what the actual status is on that, but I think I heard him talk about this once. And we also need, even if we have multiple modes, we'll also need to be able to populate them with a total of more than one photon. Right? If we keep it at one photon with multiple modes, it doesn't scale. And if we keep it at one mode and multiple photons, it doesn't scale. So you need both of them to grow in order to scale. And now the degrees of freedom, one of them is polarization, as mentioned. Of course, there's space, time, and also sometimes forgotten, we can use the intensity itself of the field as a degree of freedom. Now, if we look at those in detail, in real space, I guess the most popular one among theorists is dual rail encoding, where you have a photon living in either of two. I don't know if there's any way to erase this board here. People are writing a lot here. So, photon can live in either of two rails, and if it lives in the bottom one, we'll call that zero in the computational base, and if it lives in the upper one, we'll call it a one. And to a certain extent, that's not so much different from, if we restrict the total photon number to one, then that's not very much different from using polarization for a theorist. For an experimentalist, it makes a big difference. Right? What's the reason for that difference? I'll come into that a little later again, but if you make this on an optical table, you have to make sure that the path lengths here, so from here to here, are not drifting relative to each other. That's hard. Even on a one-ton steel optical tabletop, this stuff will change. You know, you have somebody standing there radiating some heat onto your table, and suddenly this will expand, and you'll have to keep track of those spaces. Whereas if you do it with polarization, this doesn't matter, because they propagate on the same path. So for polarization, the only thing that matters are birefringent, as we call them, phases.
So by rail encoding, do you mean that the light follows the same path?
Yes, what I mean here is that in reality, these would be Gaussian beams, because we know that if we constrain them in space, they have to have some divergence. So if you draw lines in practice, there'll be some kind of beams, and you'll need lenses to keep them in places, lenses and mirrors. That's what we mean by rate. And this is actually what I wrote here. Gaussian beams are rate encoding. You can do different things. You can do, for example, if you have sources that are very small, then your photons might come out in certain spherical waves, and you might pick out some sectors of those spheres for encoding information. But in practice, if you want to chain this to something else, you'll always go back to some kind of beam-like geometry. But then, yet another thing you can do, which solves part of this phase problem here, is that you can use different transverse wavefronts. Now, if you look at these here, these blobs. This is a Gaussian mode, and those are like air Gaussian modes, which have solutions to a I guess, paraxial approximation of the Maxwell's equations with circular boundary conditions, then it's interesting to know that these, if you have any optical system which is not astigmatic, meaning that it's not asymmetric between one direction across the wavefront and another direction, these will propagate without change, without any relative phases. So I can have a superposition of this and that propagate through a lens system, and they will keep their phase. Which does not, and in practice, that's very useful because it means that you won't have any phase errors on the optical cable. Whereas here, those might occur easily.
So you take a superposition, there's different rings with like different size holes in the middle.
Right.
And those are basically orthogonal
properties. They are orthogonal states. They are basically, you solve this, basically the equation of a circular resonator or beam, and you'll get the Laguerre-Gaussian polynomials for the radial wave function. And those actually have the round one. There's another series. You can, depending on the boundary conditions that you impose, if you do rectangular boundary conditions, you get Hermite Gaussian ones, which have they look a bit different, but they're also another orthogonal mode system. You can convert one into the other.
Can you divide them into a beam splitter?
Well, you can, if you just send this onto beam splitter, half of such a thing will go one way and half of it will go the other way, or if you have one photon, it will go one way or the other way. And one photon itself can be in that mode. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, but what we actually don't have for these is a polarizing one. So let's say that. We don't have a beam splitter that takes any superposition and gives you this component, that component, and then third component deterministically. Doesn't mean that it wouldn't exist, but nobody's built it really. Sure.
So the latter thing you're talking about is sort of trying to do a measurement about those three states that are talking about.
Eventually, yeah. We know how to do measurements on these, even for single photons, using holograms and fibers for projection. What we don't have is the equivalent of a Stern-Gerlach or polarizer. We can only project into on this one really. This is what we can do, and then with some tricks you can project on any other one, but we cannot do a full measurement that yields every output.
How do you create the reversal by using small?
You use an optical fiber which has a single mode optical fiber whose mode is exactly like that. So it has zero overlap with all the other ones.
Okay, so you have the equivalent of a polarizer.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, we have a one-channel polarizer, if you will. And because we can transform between them, we can also project onto any other one. But if we want to, measure all the amplitudes, if we had a superposition, we'd have to split the beams randomly and then project. So you have a loss building. Mm-hmm. Can
transform between them?
You use a hologram that changes, basically. So this is a flat phase front, or say slightly curved phase front, whereas that is a spiral. So you take a hologram that adds that spiral. Yeah, I was not planning on. I can talk some other time. I can talk about this in a lot of
detail.
But it's a fun topic. And actually, I could have talked about that. We just recently did an experiment using these modes for a three-state QKD system. So I can talk about that at a later time.
Just a quick question.
Sure.
When you don't get the first outcome, do you lose the coherence among the last two outcomes?
In this very mode, yes.
Okay.
Right? But if I had to use a beam splitter too, if I get this one outcome, then yes, I will have to project it onto that outcome. And if I don't get it, I would still have lost the photon into. Might have lost the photon into this channel, so it might get completely lost. Maybe I should. No, we have time to talk. So what I would do, I would take the beam, I take the beam splitter, and maybe split it again. So then I have three outputs. And this one I might project on zero. And this one I might project on one, and this one I might project on two. But you see, it's possible that I get no outcome at all, even though my photon lived in the space of some superposition of even though I go in with this, it could happen that I get no outcome. So in a way, it's just another loss. It's not really, the coherence.
That's because the detectors aren't perfect? Or?
No, that's because this is a beam splitter, which is insensitive to, maybe this is not it. This is insensitive to the mode. So this will basically take, if this is psi, then I'll have like one-third psi here, one-third psi, another one-third, one-third psi, and then that could project onto two. So if all of the amplitudes will just be scaled by a third, or the probabilities, I should say. So this is useful for doing things on the table, but I guess only if you're interested in having more than two basis states. Because otherwise I guess you'd go with polarization. I couldn't see it. All right. Now, this was space. So this is all using the spatial degree of freedom of the photon. Now, we can also use time. And we can do that in two different ways. Again, we can use frequencies. So this would be most close to NMR, I guess, where you also address your qubits by frequency. You could as well have photons of different wavelength and use those as your basis states. And there's no problem preparing superpositions of those frequencies. Now, since that is easy to understand, I'll spend a little more time on what's called time encoding or Frenz interferometry. And I think I found a nice way of explaining what happens here. If you think of a Bach-Zehnder interferometer that's spread out over a very long optical setup, or even between stations, you have the same problem. And in between here, if you forget about those beam splitters there, it looks like the dual rail representation of a photon. Right? And now think of some hostile environment in between. I told you that even on an optical table, it's hard to keep those phases stable. So even worse in a real environment. Now, one trick that people found is that if you, instead of doing that, do this, you sort of multiplex the two modes onto one mode. And now I draw here something that's not actually beam splitter. If you want to do this ideally, you need some kind of switch. And you realize that's a little shaky here, because in a way you need to discretize time before you can do the switching stuff. You need to know that the photon wave pattern is sort of in this non-arm here before you operate your switch. So what that means, if you have photon wave packets coming here, you basically multiplex the two states onto one rail, and then here you demultiplex. And what people would do in reality very often, instead of having very fast switches there, because that switch has to be as fast as the, has to operate in the time that it takes for the photon wave pack to propagate around this little loop there. And if this little loop is this size, and that means 1 nanosecond, billion second. Now that's not so easy to do. So what people do in practice is that they put real beam splitters here instead of switches, and that means they lose half of their light down this way, and the same at the other end. Well, they lose half of their light. No, actually, this end, wait a second. Is there any loss? Maybe not. No. Maybe no loss at this end. Well, there's some loss. I shouldn't say. Because the only components that interfere will be the ones that, you know, in here you have two components that interfere at the time of beam splitters. But this guy produces two components, and that guy produces another two components, and now you have two of them that interfere and two that don't interfere. Right? So you have four in total. And so if you do this with beam splitters, you'll always have a 50% loss built in. And that may be a problem for any experiments where you don't like post-selection things. So if you have this without switches, it will always be close to that on the fact of detecting the photons at the right time out there, the two output points. So this comes under different labels. The original one, I guess, invented by Jim Frenzen, And then for discretized times, it's called time bin encoding. And another, I guess, advanced version is called differential phase shift keying, which is a term that comes from telecommunications. And what it means is that you take a laser that outputs this train of pulses, and you encode the information in the relative phase between the pulses. So you need some fast modulator, and you basically shift those pulses around by either zero or whatever phase you want to type to. And then you do the same interferometry like here between any successive pair of pulses. Which means that your qubit is sort of located between the pulses, not on the pulse. So it's a little odd. But I guess with modern modulation schemes and telecommunication, nothing is very clear. I don't know if you know about how this works on wireless. It's very complicated, actually. I won't look into that. And so I guess this is going to come into the quantum world. If more telecom engineers design quantum communication systems, we'll see much more complicated encoding schemes that are, by the way they're made, more fault tolerant or more tolerant against the noise that comes from the environment. Now, the final one after we're done with space and time is using the intensity degree of freedom. And one thing you can do is you can just use a number of Fox states, preferably the lower end ones, so vacuum 1, 2 photons. But another thing you could do is, and what many people do, for example, Alex Lobovsky in Calgary and Philippe Pongier, people in Erlang, is use quadrature encoding. So where you actually you work away from the vacuum state, and you encode your information into the noise. So the information is not actually encoded into the number of photons, but into the variance of the photon number in a way. And you plot these states in a plane given by the two quadrature components of your state. And so there's different ways of doing this, but I don't know. I'm not an expert, so I won't go into too many details. One example where people used an encoding like this for having a three-state system, 0, 1, and with 0, 1, and 2, where 0, 1, and 2 here means the three basis states, and also vacuum 1 and 2 photons, was done by Vic Baumeister in Santa Barbara. Now, so this is the photon space. And now let's talk about how we operate on photons. And so this comes to my next part of the talk, elements of quantum information process. Now, for most of the things, we need sources or state preparation. And we'll have to use single photon sources, and there's a number of possible ways of doing these. You can use quantum dots, single atoms, single molecules, or what's also very popular, use photon pairs and then take one as a trigger and feed the other one to the system. So you have a conditional single photon source. And I'll have a little blob again for using pairs here. The other thing is that for many things we also need entangled state per se, not just as a single photon, and we can do these from parametric down conversion. You'll hear much more about this later. Also for people then also with single atoms, but also single quantum dots. Well, I shouldn't say that. I think so far we don't have an entangled quantum dot source. All right, and then to do justice to the people working continuous variables or with quadratures, we also need sources for squeezed states. So squeezed states, I hope you know, are the ones where we suppress one noise component in order and enlarging the other one, and the information is sort of encoded into how much that squeezing is into the phase of the squeezing. All right, so I'll give you a little intro to the quantum dot. Quantum dot is a little island here. You can actually see them. That's an atomic force microscope. The image. So little islands of indium arsenide and gallium arsenide. And the indium arsenide has a smaller band gap, so it captures electrons and it captures holes. So if you hit this with a laser, you can put in some electrons and holes, and after a while it can decay and you can have a photon coming out. And if you do it right, there'll only be one photon. So you can take the last photon, which is a different wavelength than the other photons, so you'll have one photon only. And in order to make it make those better coupled, you put them into little pillars that are resonators for the photons, and that way you get the lifetimes down, you get them out faster. And I guess the one performance criterion that you need is the second order coherence of zero time delay, which has to do with the number of two photon events, and that's what you want to suppress. So this is a graph here, and all these pictures are from Chalmers and Torrey, my colleague at Stanford. This picture is basically a measurement of the arrival times between photons. If you have a time difference of zero, you never find two photons. And you measure this by putting in a beam splitter and measuring on both ends and measuring the time differences, and you never find a zero time difference. And this 0.01 tells you how much this is suppressed, right? So there's a little bit of noise down there. But this is exceptionally good compared to any other single photon source. And I guess the other important criterion is the efficiency. So if you have a single photon source, you have some vacuum amplitude, I don't know, zero, and one photon amplitude, and then some two photon amplitude. And the G2 somehow relates to C2 here, but it's not the same thing. And so you want this to be big, and that to be small, and I guess this would be the efficiency. And this is a calculated external efficiency of 40% or 35, so 37. And of course, in practice, you want this to be very large. But depending on the experiment, you may not even care about the efficiency so much. You may care more about avoiding two photons. And I guess so far, nothing better has been demonstrated than this one here. And work here has also shown by Lee and Casey that you cannot really improve a lot. If you have something that's bad with the two photon component, by linear optics, you cannot improve a lot. Well, not at all. And a lot of details of that.
Sure. Do you know the relative phase between the one photon component and the vacuum? Or is that actually an incoherence position?
Between the one photon and the vacuum? That's a good question. Let me put it this way. You can make, if you take two photons of successive events, you can see them interfere. Does that answer your question? You can do interferometry between two successive single photons, but not. Wait a second. Not. It's second order interference, so it's not. You can do this. I'll show you something, and I don't know if that answers the question. So what you could do is you could have or let me put it this way: you could have one dot emitting one photon, and you could have another dot emitting another photon. Assuming you were able to make them, you know, very much alike in terms of frequency, you could do this. You could have them hit the beam splitter, and you'll find that they'll always come out in pairs. Is that enough?
So there you're post-selecting on the cases where you really do have one photon in each. I was really more asking about the phase between the one photon
one
and the vacuum.
Photon and back with this. How would you test that?
Can you test it with, you can split it up into the from the dining on
each
shelf and shelves.
So like this?
Some
laser here.
Yeah. Oscillator from the one meter.
Right, so measure, basically measure the Wigner function or so of this.
Yeah.
Interesting question. I don't really know. I have a suspicion that you find it to be incoherent in this sense. And you know why? Because the pumping, the way we pump the stock, we send in the laser, but if you look at the level scheme, you have the, I'll have to get into a little more detail, electron and hole levels. And so this would be the transition energy. But we actually pump something at a much higher energy and just wait for the dot to capture electrons and holes. So those are all random processes. So the phase of that pump laser is completely lost. And now if you were to derive that local oscillator from the pump laser, you would not see it here.
Whether even if you would find an error,
right? I mean, it's the same as might even be the same as saying that a photon from here and a photon from there would not show first order interference, right? I guess first order interference, like in the Michaels or Mach-Zehnder interferometer, where you just have the intensity, linear intensity, going one way or the other by changing a phase here. The second order interference, Hong-Mandel interference, is insensitive to the phase there. So it's intensity interference in a way. Whereas, I guess if those were coherently emitted, and I think that's the same phase as the one you asked before, the same as this one, then what you would actually see is, one photon going either here or there, or well, one photon coming out in total if you could pump two dots coherently away. Interesting question. Okay, wow. Time is flying. All right, so let me say something about preparing higher entangled states. We have shown the GHC states, four photons in Vienna, the five photon experiment done by Zhen Wei Pan's Chinese group. And it basically works by taking two pairs, and doing a kind of parity check. So you take two pairs that are in some entangled state, it doesn't really matter which one, 2 psi minuses, 2 psi pluses or so, and then you do a measurement, and all the ones that I'm quoting here, cluster states, in Vienna, approximately W states, all of them are post-selective. So this we claim that if we had a measurement that's not that wouldn't be destructive to the photon, we could do it pre-selective. I don't know how you want to call this. So the QND, quantum non-dilation measurement, is another topic that I won't even deal with. And so that would be a measurement that would tell you the presence of a photon without destruction. And that's something we can't really do. And so this is again examples of where we need lots of pairs to make multiple states. And to give you some numbers in practice, if you say for a given experiment, we might create 20,000 pairs. Then we might also create 20 double pairs per second. So maybe we should put 10 seconds here. So or two double pairs per second. Okay. So you see this is a factor of 10 to the 4. Now you go to pairs to the third per second. This sucks. And that's taking sort of the best numbers that we could do. Obviously, there's two things that matter here. One is the detection efficiency, and the other one is the pair production rate. And if you can increase, I guess detection efficiency matters more for the scaling, But in practice, production efficiency matters a lot. Because we do this with very powerful lasers, and it's not, you know, something you can do. So if you want to go to a 6-photon thing with resources, and the 6-photon GHC would be easily doable with that, you'd rather have some source that is a little box with just electrical wires coming and spitting out photon waves. And then you can do that. All right.
PBS measurement, you may have explained it.
Okay. Oh, PBS is just, so we're doing some kind of parity check here, meaning that you put a polarizing beam splitter there, and because a polarizing beam splitter is one that transmits horizontal or zero and reflects the one, you will only find, if you project on the states, or if you, select on the states that produce, give you a photon here and there, you will pick out the terms that will have HH in these two here, or BB. So it will project onto that. I should write it like this, I think. Actually, I should write it like this.
Does it stand for partial Del state measurements or plus?
No, it stands for polarizing beam splitter and measurement. It's not partial Del state measurement. Yeah, I like that. Because in an entangled swapping setting, it would be a partial Del state measurement. Very good. So it would be this really, projection onto sort of even terms. I don't know what you want to call them. So this is what it does.
It's coherent.
Well, no, it's projectors here. So, is it coherent? Was that a question or?
I was looking at coherent projection onto the
yeah.
But it's a projector, so it's a projector on a two-dimensional subspace.
Right.
Okay. No, because I think we just picked out one Del state. But if the incoming state.
Oh, you know, this one doesn't pick out Del states.
No, this doesn't.
Okay. No, this doesn't. It picks out HHs and BBs. Whether the components are coherent or not doesn't matter. I think anyway, it's only. In practice, it doesn't really matter because you only get the projection after you've detected a photon here, right? The beam splitter itself doesn't project. The beam splitter itself just sends photons different ways, and I guess therefore it's all just destructive preparation here. So I couldn't really call it preparation. It's a misnomer. Okay, so let me go into single qubit gates. Now, for you theoreticians, I've copied you from a catalog, a real wave plate and a real beam splitter. That's what it is. And so this does have four inputs, but let's say you come from here, and unfortunately the screen doesn't really show this diagonal line in here, and you'll get one component there and one component there. And if you want, so what I want to say is if you want to do a static gate, meaning some rotation of a fixed angle or something that you can set in human time on a human time scale, you can do this very precise. If you're willing to pay a little more, you can do it with, I don't know, four zeros or four nines beyond the comma of the 99%. So this is easy, and for polarization qubits you would have wave plates, basically birefringent elements that give you a different light speed for some two axes. And that can give you any single qubit rotation anywhere in the block sphere, really.
Does that consist of two pieces that are glued together?
Very good. Experts here. There's two kinds. There's one kind where you have one piece only, and then there's are you asking about this one or about the top one?
The bottom one.
The bottom one has two pieces, but the top one has two pieces as well. the bottom one has two pieces. It's two three-sided prisms, and they have a layer in between. And this layer is made to be either a beam splitter, which is insensitive to polarization, and that was the next thing I was about to say. You would think that a non-polarizing beam splitter would be the easiest thing you could buy, but it turned out it's the worst. It's much easier to make a good polarizing beam splitter with lots of nines at the 99, but it's very difficult to make a very symmetric beam splitter for that is polarization insensitive. And you'll find that even the ones that you think are polarization insensitive will have some very weird faces applied to the two polarizations. And in practice, if you want something that is your ordinary Hadamard, you'll have to tweak phases on every output and input to get it right. So that's very tricky. But anyway, still, you can still do it very nicely. But if you, and that's what you need for linear optic quantum computation, if you need to do this dynamic, so do the rotation as, you know, conditioned on the result of the previous measurement, you need to do it fast and quick, right? You need to do it before the photon reaches this thing. So this is the issue of feed forward. If you want to do this, some detection, and then I guess some gate on the other conditional rotation, you need to have a very fast signal going from here to there. Now it turns out you can buy very fast modulators, no problem. You can buy qubit rotators, if you will, that operate on up to 60 gigahertz. That's really fast. But the trouble is that detectors will be sort of slow, medium slow, nanosecond. And also, most of these modulators will take a little time before they actually operate. They'll have some static delay of a few nanoseconds. So even though they operate at very high speeds, they'll take a while before they actually process the signal that you send to them a while before. And I found that to be an almost universal law in all the moments I ever searched for. And so this may be a big issue. The other thing is also that the ones that are very fast have relatively high losses, 50%. So that's not very nice to have. And if you do it in bulk, this part here, you're slower. And also you have really big machines. So one modulator that can do 100 megahertz comes with so it's a piece of, you know, copper cell this size, and it comes with an electronic crate of this by this by this, about 100 kilos in weight for one fast rotator or bulk system. So not very nice. Okay, what's the next thing? Two qubit gates. Of course, we'd like to have in not linear, but just optical quantum computation, we'd like to have gates that are deterministic. And we know that in vacuum, photons just, you know, pass through each other, I guess, to very, very good approximation, as far as we know. And so there's no interaction, no non-linearity. So if we want to do non-linear optics, people have tried to boost this up. I'm doing nonlinear optics in just transparent crystals, and it's very weak. For creating photon pairs, for every photon we send in, we get 10 to the minus 10 pairs out. And so if you think of doing something between one photon and one photon, you're at a total loss. You get phase shifts, cross phase shifts of 10 to the minus 10. Now, the best result so far was done with a single atom in a very small optical resonator by Jeff Kimball's group at Caltech, where he got a phase shift of 16 degrees with and that required a lot of, you know, experimental skill. People are trying to look at other systems, for example, the atomic vapors. This also comes under the name electromagnetically induced transparency, where you play with the coherence between atomic levels to change the optical properties of your medium to a state where you have extreme group velocities and extreme nonlinearities. And we'll also look at waveguides and regular nonlinear optical materials, microcavities and everything. I think there's still a lot of research to be done in nonlinear optics for gates. We've actually seen some. This is an experiment I did with a colleague at Stanford. Somehow this projection leaving some of my beams out here. So this is an interferometer to test the nonlinear modulation in this device here. We have a signal beam and the probe beam is part of the interferometer, and we measure the phase. And we found phase shifts very small but promising. So this might work in some future. And then there's another suggestion, and I think Casey would be the right person to talk about this. How could you make very weak nonlinearities work for you? And I guess the suggestion goes in the following way, that you take some strong beam and you let the nonlinearity interact, the strong beam with the weak beam, with the single photon. And if you do this, so in this way, if you do this multiple times, you can couple two qubits to the same strong field, and in that way, sort of get an enhancement by the strong field for your interaction between the two qubits. Another suggestion is to do everything on a very long, say in a fiber or so, weak nonlinearity, but distributed over a long fiber, and in that way, you might also be able to get certain nonlinear gates. Now, obviously, the mode, I think I might be able to skip some of that here. We know that linear optics can do the same thing in a way if we have the feed forward, and we also know by now that the maximum probability of a single linear optic gate could be 25%, which is not too bad. Again, I'd like to point out that I guess the most practical implementations use entangled pairs. So again, there's some need for entangled pairs. And I think I'm running out of time here, since we had some nice discussion. So I think I'll just skip the second part of my talk. Talk a little more. Talk and do this some other time. Talk a little more about components here. For detection, there's a variety of things. I think what's the oldest kind is a photomultiplier. You know, something where you have a photocathode, photon hits that photocathode and creates an electron, and that electron then jigs through a number of dynamos, as they are called, and you get some measurable electron pulse out. Then there's solid state versions. The avalanche photodiodes, that's the stuff we use. Silicon avalanche photodiodes work very nicely. Like, silicon has been engineered to be very pure, and therefore you can create very efficient devices that don't have a whole lot of noise. Whereas in other materials that you'd like to work with, because silicon is not efficient at all if you look at telecom wavelength. So you'd like to work with other materials, but those are much dirtier, and so even the best devices you can get have a lot of noise at any reasonable efficiency. You need to cool them off. So people have looked into other things, also because these avalanche photodiodes cannot distinguish between one and multiple photons, whereas photomultipliers sort of can. And so people have developed solid-state photomultipliers. Those can distinguish between higher photon numbers, but they have some other drawbacks. They're relatively slow and very cumbersome to operate. And then all our hope is in superconducting detectors, and we have a guy there in engineering at the university who's trying to develop superconducting transition edge sensors. And maybe a short explanation, you have a superconductor and you basically bias it at a critical current. And if a photon comes in and creates a little hot spot or a little normal conducting area in that superconductor, it'll give you a voltage spike. And it all, the sensitivity of the detector all depends on the slope of this curve here, where we have, this is basically current, and this is, I guess, resistance. And this will be the critical current. And then I guess from the other regime of using continuous variables, you do homodyne detection. Homodyne detection is known to be very efficient because you sort of bias your detector away from the zero photon limit with the local oscillator. So apparently, people can resolve distinguish between 100 and 101 photons with 99% efficiency. It's quite amazing. On the other hand, it's very slow also. In particular, I'm always puzzled in terms of if you do tests of bells and qualities, so and you want to put time on your event, I find it very hard because it's a sort of continuous. It's all a continuous measurement, and you need to work with some inverse filter bandwidth to find when your event has occurred. It's a little strange. What people normally do is they just hook this up to a spectrum analyzer and measure the frequency content of whatever signal they get in. And then the spectrum analyzer determines their measurement time. And it's very hard, and I talked to Alex Wolfson, it's very hard to make those very fast. So for many things, that's maybe not that useful. All right, finally, storage. When we think of photons, sometimes they're called flying qubits, and that's what they do best. They fly, they don't like to stay in a place. And if you try to lock them up, it is tough. You can do loops of fiber, very long loops. You can buy telecom fiber that has attenuation of 0.1 dB per kilometer, and if you translate that into attenuation per time, you get about 1% per microsecond. That's not so bad, actually, if you think about it. If you have a switch to switch it in and out, because within that microsecond, you might be able to do maybe 1,000 gates with very fast switches. So that's not too bad. And I think technologically, it's better than any of the other stuff I'm proposing here. It looks a little crude.
His attenuation is for the fiber itself. How much to send it in that fiber?
Oh, into the fiber. Yeah. Well, I guess from outside to inside, you can do about 70% coupling. But obviously, what you'd like to do is everything in the fiber already, right? You never like to go out and back in.
But somebody has to branch out, to say, if you want to keep it in memory, so you have to send it somewhere.
But it still stays in the fiber. You switch it in the fiber. You have to switch that sort of,
connection. What's the precision of those switch?
They're a little lossy. I mentioned before the modulators had 50% loss, and that's the same thing. Same thing here. If you, I guess there's one example where this is from Jim Francis, where he tried some storage using photon pairs, using one as a trigger, and then using the other one to sort of switch it in and out. But they work at a different wavelength, so the attenuation is much worse, and they could only store for, I think, 100 nanoseconds at most. The other thing is that you could use the slow light techniques, as mentioned before, using some dilute atomic vapor. You have some control beam that changes controls the coherence between levels, and you get into regimes where the group velocity of light, so the derivative of, the refractive index with wavelength is very, very, so the group velocity is very low, meaning you have a very small d omega decay. Not everyone's familiar with that concept. Group velocity is the derivative of the frequency with respect to the wave vector. Whereas the phase velocity is just omega divided by k. And you can make that very, very small. You can take, so you have this very long pulse that propagates in free space, comes into the zone, change the control laser, and it sort of compresses in space and time. And it stays in there, and you can make it stop. And that, what that actually means is that you sort of create a coherent population of atoms that has information of the light field. And then changing the control laser, which is sort of put in from another side or another wavelength, you can make it move back out again. So far, I think the storage efficiencies that they've seen are about 5%. And they can also store for microseconds. And then the storage time there is limited by collisions within the atoms, so decaying of the atomic memories. And anyway, so other suggestions are photonic crystal waveguides, or just sort of series of coupled resonators, where each resonator gives you a little storage time, and you can describe that chain of resonators with a certain group velocity as well. So something where light propagates very slowly. And I guess for all the other parts, so this is where light is, in a way, stored as light, whereas I guess all the more practical implementations would probably consider coupling your photons to some ion trap memory, atom memory, or even superconducting memory if your photons are in a microwave regime, and then having stored there, and then transmitting the photon once you're ready to do the rest. All right, so one more thing that I've talked about, well, maybe for all of you, I wanted to talk a bit about errors in transmitting photons. And we'll distinguish two cases, one the free space case and the other the fiber case. Now, I already mentioned that it's hard to keep track of phases, even on an optical cable. But losses are very, very good, or very, very small. Right? If you have good optical elements, you won't lose more than a small fraction of a percent per element. Over long distance, so if you go outside, and that's what we'll do with our QKE system, where we want to, you know, send photons from our place to your place here, if you don't, may not know that yet, but you'll see. You run into problems of turbulence that gives you phase errors, so it will distort your wavefront, meaning that the phase of your beam is not homogeneous anymore, so you have some actual decoherence across the wavefront. So you shouldn't encode in phase, you should encode in polarization, obviously. And you'll also get a lot of loss if you stay near the ground. Whereas if you wanted to do gates that are based on interferometers, it turns out that if you do it in free space on an optical table, every optician will tell you that it's very hard to create an interferometer with a contrast of more than 95%. So your gate fidelity, if it involves interferometric combination of beams, would be very tough. If you think of the linear optic quantum computation schemes and you want to build them on a table like they are, it'd be very tough. Now, in a fiber, things are a bit different.
Sure. So
why is that? I think it's just hard to get. You have two beams, and since they're not lines, but they're Gaussian beams like this, and now you have the beam splitter. The other beam comes in like so. It's just difficult to match position, angle, and divergence at the same time, independently. Because there's a lot of parameters for both beams. And then you also have to get, I guess. But that's something you're welcome to come to our lab and just try it. but it's a very nice experience. It takes you about 5 minutes, and you realize that it's not so easy to get those interferometers really light and dark, right? You'll always see stripes. If you don't want stripes, you want one nice bright blob. Yeah. So if you go to fibers, things are different. Phases in the way are very, very unstable with fiber as well, because fiber is even worse than air. In air, you get phase modulations from just temperature differences, and more so in fibers, because the fiber will expand and contract on expansion, on thermal changes. It will be sensitive to acoustic noise. Also, polarization will be lost in the fiber over a long distance. Short distance, you don't lose polarization. You just get a semi-unitary transformation that you can do backwards. No problem. But if you go over a very long distance, you have some kind of random walk depolarization, which comes from sort of built-in stresses in the fiber. They are randomly oriented along the fiber, so eventually you run into some random walk-like thing. And if you want to do gates in the fiber, we know, I've already told you that the modulators you get there are very lossy. But on the other hand, if you build interferometers, they can have very high visibility. For the exact same reason, in the fiber, you won't have this problem of matching the beams. You'll have one mode, exactly one mode, and it'll overlap perfectly, basically. No. One thing that I think is, I don't know if that's been taken care of, maybe you can instruct me. Detect the dark tones. Sort of the inverse of photon loss. It's, I don't know how you model that in terms of an error. I don't know if it's even important, photon gain.
Well, I mean, so if there was already a photon coming in, the dark tone doesn't really matter, right? So,
well, let me see, a dark count is something where you get a count where the incoming state is vacuum, but you get some result.
Right. So, so it really depends on the context. If it's vacuum because you lost a photon due to earlier attenuation, then that's just, you know, an error, right? It's just something random happens to the state and you're replaced by another random state.
Okay. I'm more thinking about if you had a dual rail thing and you went in with some state, but suddenly you detect two photons.
Right. So that's something that you know that you shouldn't be seeing.
Right.
So that's also kind of a random error, but you know it's an error. So that's
okay.
So it's basically the same thing as a leakage error.
Leakage error.
So if you do that detection and get no photons,
It's awesome. Yeah, it tells you almost exactly the same correlation as seeing two photons.
True.
So would you also employ the same correction?
Yeah.
Would you do the same encoding?
Yes. Yeah. Let's start anew.
Yeah. All right. And then I guess the final little thing there, if you really want to do any serious optical quantum information processing, you need to get this stuff onto some kind of chip. And I was about in the second half, like, I was about to tell you how to do stuff on chips, but I guess I'll do that next time. Thank you.
I want a short answer. Okay. Is it realistic to do this on a chip in a reasonable year or two?
Year or two is a little tall order, but depends on what you want. Yep. Think with a few beams for this and stuff, you can do.
You're recorded now.
Yeah. I didn't say I could do it.
How big would these chips be?
I think they might be centimeter size length. And then it depends on the technology. The regular waveguides don't tolerate very strong bends, so you have to keep them somewhat reasonably big. But then the more modern ones, the photonic crystal ones that the industry doesn't like because they're so hard to fabricate, there you can do 90-degree bends, so you can actually integrate better.
Like go around the corner.
Yeah, you can go back. You can make it go around the corner pretty much.
So what is the stage for classical information processing with on chips?
On chips,
people use them or the telecommunications?
Small chips are being used in optical switches. Small chips. So they would involve like 2-3 modulators, beam splitters on one unit, and they are usually used to, you know, you have this communication signal coming in. They're used to take one channel out or bring one channel in, add drop multiplexing, that's what they call it,
yeah.
or to do some frequency mixing between different signals, and I guess that's what you can buy from Norco for a lot of money. The trouble with a lot of this stuff is not to be you can't underestimate how much electronics you need to actually supply the signal to those fast circuits. Because you talk about, you know, you want to modulate a lot of information onto one channel. You need to get all that information into one thing. So you start with a big crate of electronics that costs a lot of money to feed this one little thing that you mentioned.
Sounds like an NMR machine.
Sure.
What do you think the most promising way to do long distance quantum communication?
I think the satellite stuff. From a satellite, you can broadcast down pairs. And it turns out that the optical density or the optical properties of the atmosphere from a satellite down are not much different than going about 10 kilometers near ground. And that's quite amazing. Satellite, of course, is the lowest satellites are about 200 kilometers above surface. Now that's quite far, meaning even if you have a big beam, it'll spread out quite a bit, so it'll have large loss. But if you were to just broadcast pairs down and you don't care about the loss, entangled pairs, you can still create a reasonable, you know, entangled channel on the ground with that, I think. The trouble with the very low satellites is that they are extremely fast. I mean, you zoom across the sky like this. So there's a trade-off between, you know, oh, yeah, like this, seriously. They have telescopes like this. Telescopes like that. Incredible speeds. So if you were to go to a higher satellite, you might catch more time, but then you also have more loss. It's a trade-off. And I think there's almost no way to go to a geostationary satellite. That's 36,000 kilometers.
But with all the losses, what would the rate on the ground be?
I think you could do... We have some serious source up there. You could do maybe... few hundred a second, a few thousand a second. So you have to, I guess you have to accumulate them differently. Right? If you want to use an entanglement to enhance or to do QKD or do repeaters or teleportation, you need to accumulate them and store them.
So to rephrase Rob's question, if you want to do quantum field between two cities, which I'll put 1,000 meters down there from each other, your bet is go through satellite instead of try to build quantum repeaters.
I think use the satellite to make the basic thing for the repeater. Yeah, do, I don't know, building, if you have some very good local memory, maybe building repeaters from little fiber, you know, little distance that you cover by fiber, which could be 100 kilometers, so you'd have 10 segments on that plane. Now that involves quite a bit of, I guess, purification and entanglement and swapping. I think that brings you down to pretty much the same, or probably lower rate than going through the satellite. Except that, I don't know, the question about availability of the satellite, if you only see it for a few minutes every hour, then I don't know if you can, I'm thinking you could do 100 per second average over a day, which is not a lot. Yeah.
What wavelength were they using to send from satellite?
Nothing's been actually sent from a satellite. What my colleagues have done is bounce something off a satellite. So send it up for a telescope and bounce it down and receive it back. And that wavelength is usually in the green. It turns out that all the visible wavelengths go through pretty much.
So is that at a single photon level?
Yeah. Not what went out, but what came back. but their next step is to hook up one of those down conversion sources and send single minutes. And the trouble is, if you bounce it off a satellite, but that satellite is nothing more than a ball with little mirrors on it.
Yeah.
So it's very, very bad. It'd be much, much better to have a source up there with a reasonable telescope that points down in some kind of beam.
So what was the loss across the length of
the... I think the total loss budget gives you about 10 to the minus 8 or so, setting it up and bouncing it off. And you have to imagine those reflectors on those satellites are about this size, and the thing spins. So it's like this ball, the disco ball. It's lost. We had to put it here and went there.
Did you have to tell them?
The people who own the satellite, they wouldn't know. I think you still have to tell, or the people who have telescopes on the ground will tell them. But only because people put a satellite up like to have your data, because they use that data really for ranging. They map the gravitational field of the Earth using these satellites, but the thing is, you need the telescope. And those telescopes are very, very serious. They're as I mentioned, this size, and they can move at incredible speeds. Really cool stuff.
Sure. I had a quick question for Scorch. It might be the same as the was it the slow light out there, or is it the second off?
Yeah,
I read it in the Scientific America one about freezing light. I thought
right.
The mechanism that was, is it the same?
It's the same mechanism. What really happens is you take an atomic system that has some kind of a lambda transition like this, and then the light you want to store is resonant with one of the transitions, and the control laser is resonant with another transition, and basically by shining that other laser, you can pump this into a state where it appears dark, or get transparent on that transition. And depending on how you play with, if this is state one and that's state two, you play with creating some kind of superposition of the two states. And depending on what that is, you can create arbitrary dispersion for this transition.
Can you leave the information that in the state of the
yeah, it's basically, yeah, that's what you do. Yeah, so as long as it propagates, you think you have some propagating light wave, but it's actually a wave that's half in the light and half in the atoms. And when you stop it, it's all in the atoms. So it's the way you couple it together. So I'm not actually sure if I could call it byte storage or more an interface to atomic memory.
Can you explain the quantum Turing coding again?
I don't know if I'm really the expert for that. But I think basically this is based on you have some phase space, and this could be your x coordinate and p coordinate of the field, right? Here in state would look like we have these lollipop diagrams, and then the actual information goes into the delta p and delta x, and you know delta p and delta x are bounded by some uncertainty relation, something here, a bar. And now you can start playing with the shape of this. Like if you make ellipse like so, then this will be a different state. So you can do a variety of things. And I guess that's it.
Did they try to encode a qubit within
the quantum? That's actually a very good question that I don't have an answer for. And that's if you have a certain resolution of your measurement, right? Because you somehow need to specify a digitization of the analog quantity. What is the qubit content of your system? That's something I'd be very interested to have answered, but I don't know. Because you're dealing with a continuous variable system here in a way. X and P are continuous variables. And how do we know how many qubits there are in this continuous variable system? Has a lot to do with your measurement bandwidth and this, right? If you know your resolution in X and you know your resolution in P, I guess you can. I don't know if you could chop this up into little blobs of h bar squared.
It's not clear how, with linear optics you can do a certain number of things, but if you really want to go, that's something that's difficult to simulate. How do you do that?
Oh, in here?
To use these in a quantum computation to use a quantum Turing coding, what's the extra besides linear optics that you're going to be using?
Oh, you need nonlinear to make. For example, to make a state like this, you need nonlinear optics to make a squeezed state. It doesn't happen with linear optics. But also, I guess if you want to do quantum information processing, you need. The gates are relatively simple.
Yeah, a beam splitter interacts two separate modes, right?
Yeah, I think you scale up the number of modes eventually. I think you can't just have one mode and then put all the information into here.
I think it's been shown that if you take all linear optics, including squeezing, multi-mode system,
okay,
then all of that can be simulated efficiently.
That's right.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, it depends on the detector, if it's homodyne detector from like.
Right.
That's right. You only get Gaussian state stuff, I guess.
Correct. So if you have Gaussian states, Gaussian equations.
But it's the same. It's kind of the same thing with LOQC, that if you add photon number measurement, some other kind of measurement, for instance, you could get more. But there's always something that's far away. If you can create if you can create some non Gaussian states using Sansilla, that's probably not. I don't know if the general ones would be.
Then who proved that?
Well, okay, so there's a paper by me, Todd and Presco.
Okay.
So the encoding we use is not a Gaussian encoding, but we also need some kind of number or measurement.
Okay.
So the encoding, its advantage is that it's robust against small shifts or distortions in either quantum theory. So basically, it's some kind of periodic state, but we don't really have a good way of making that.
I could add one thing. I don't know if you were here for Philippe Grandier's talk No, that was at IQC. It's about quantity distribution with this kind of quadratic coding. And there, they basically divide their phase space into, they take away two stripes. So those are non-results. And these are the four states that they actually use. I don't know how that relates to using it in a more general setting. So they basically measure quadratures, and if they find a value that's, you know, in here, that's one state.
So that's one basis. How do they measure the complementary basis?
Well, I think that's related to phase shift they apply in the Hohmann measurement, the local oscillator, and then you apply phase shift.
So they just rotate that.
Yeah. We should have Alex Wolfsky here talk about this. And I think he thought a bit about the, you know, the information content of a continuous variable system. An experimental viewpoint.
Yeah, I mean, in general, of course, you could take, at least in principle, you could take your plane and just tile the circles, right? And so long as the circles don't overlap, they're orthogonal states, pretty much. So by getting, you know, larger and larger amplitudes, you could get arbitrary pain. But of course, presumably there's some limit.
Right, and also, of course, I think that many of those realizations are very, very sensitive to loss. I remember when you tried to measure the bigger function of a single solution state and tried to show that it goes negative, loss will basically even out the negativity in even the best experiments. And now if you chose an encoding with a surface like Daniel mentioned, then any loss would bring you down into another surface that gets some bad errors.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Maybe even a bigger problem is how do you create superpositions of these states? It's really more of a classical input.
Sure. I don't know enough about that.